This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books and Psychoanalysis and part two of our interview with Dr. Stephanie Swales and Dr. Carol Owens, their book, Psychoanalyzing Ambivalence with Freud and Lacan, On and Off the Couch. Dr. Owens, Dr. Swales, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us so much.
Yeah. So we've just gotten started on extimacy. We talked about, Stephanie, a little bit about in the neighbor. Our neighbor has stolen something from us. Right now in America, the neighbor has stolen the election. Mm-hmm. Something is stolen in the other. But Stephanie, you had brought us back into the clinic, back onto the couch. And since the core of the book starts on the couch, help us with extimacy on the couch and in the clinic.
Sure. One of our patients just always hated people that he perceived as borderlines, those with borderline personality disorder diagnosed by this Alisand. As you would expect, his mother was the original borderline for him. He described her as controlling, intrusive, would throw a fit if someone seemed to reject her in the slightest way. Things like, if one of the children or the father didn't want to eat one of the things she had prepared, she would round up all the food and throw it in the trash, things like that. And the Alisand in question, as a young person, tried his darndest to be the apple of her eye, and to continue with the food examples, wanted to be the favorite of the siblings and so on and so forth. But as he grew up, he, saw a kind of hateful side of his mother, and, basically in the decades that followed, had seen himself as someone who was completely different than her. He was of a different political party. He had a totally different career, different types of relationships, so on and so forth. And of course, spoiler, since I'm trying to give an example of the extimacy of jouissance, that the jouissance that he hated in her, he, through the course of the analysis, began to recognize that as his own. He was deeply disturbed when, you know, he first started recognizing the evidence of the jouissance of the other in himself, penchant for drug use and thrill seeking, picking fights with loved ones, using his so-called mental illness to try to ensure that his spouse would be too guilty, feel too guilty to leave him. Of course, his own jouissance was, reflected in some different ways than that of his mother's, but, seeing himself as a borderline, having borderline jouissance, was crucial to then being able to work through his own ambivalence about his jouissance, because he had thought of it in more of a happy light, that, he liked who he was and he was totally different than this borderline type. So to claim all of his jouissance, the jouissance that he hated and that he loved, to work through that was crucial in having a different kind of relation to the other. And of course, not just the mother, but the repetitions in his work, in his choice of relationships, things like that. So it's not always as clear, the extimacy of jouissance, as I presented it just now, certainly not to the person, him or herself, given that it tends to be perceived in the other in a somewhat distorted or disguised form, as alien to the self. And it takes quite some time to be able in analysis to see, what it is that's hated in the other reflects something of oneself.
There's what came to mind when you were talking, Stephanie, was a dream of one of my own patients. And it's interesting because one of the things that we forget sometimes, and it's what you said, it's how the jouissance of, what is extimate is actually distorted, so there's the, I suppose alienation in the first place from what is regarded as, let's say, the other's jouissance. So that's like stage one, we could say. And then there's a further alienation from recognizing that jouissance as one's own, in fact. And further, then the hatred of the jouissance of the other and the hatred of, in fact, what is one's own jouissance. So I was thinking of this dream, a really interesting dream. A woman I saw for a long time, French woman, living in Ireland for some time. And she explained to me how she was having dreams about decorating her home. And she wanted to paint the entire apartment yellow. So this was very interesting to her, because she would say to me, "No, you know what? I hate that color. I really hate that color." And she said, it's interesting because it's maybe one of the few things I have in common with my mother. We both hate the color yellow. So I got her to associate that. And it didn't take her long before she started to explain to me that, why she had so little in common with her mother was because her mother was a racist. And her mother indeed did hate the color. What she hated was not the color yellow, but the color black. And my client knew and would say to me that she didn't understand why, but she had a deep, 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 deep attraction to particularly black men. So in this curious way, she, if you like, had sutured something which for her brought her some jouissance, which was in her relationships with these black lovers, black male lovers. But which was in turn conditioned on her mother's extimate jouissance, which was a hatred of the color black. I thought that was quite interesting. Mm. Of course, there's also the example that we used in the book, which was, you know, the chap who liked to park outside, in fact, my neighbor's house, because he knew, you know, he'd realized that the chap was, my neighbor was, let's say, Eastern European, and the fantasy was how much he was annoying my neighbor by parking outside of his house. And all through the session, he'd be there ruminating on how annoyed this neighbor was going to become. And I suppose the point we made about that in the book was that how you know, you don't even need your own irritating neighbor whose jouissance you can't stand. In fact, you can use somebody else's neighbor. But of course, in the end, it was his own. You know, this was something he especially could not stand, was somebody parking outside of his home. So, of course, he imagined that the other also hated what was, you know, something he enjoyed to hate, we could say. He also imagined that my neighbor would enjoy to hate as well.
When you talk about you don't even need your own neighbor to hate, and, yeah, and the example of the dream with the association with race, you say that one of the precise points in the book, you write that this is precisely our point. Xenophobia, in its various iterations as a phobia, stands in for the lack in the other, the other's desire, the other's jouissance. These are the two faces of lack. And you can lack a neighbor and still get it done.
Yes, exactly. I think that one of the things that, indeed, building on that point that you just mentioned, Christopher, was that, and although we didn't dedicate a huge amount of space to it in the book, it's certainly something that we've been thinking about before and since, but we wanted to make the point that xenophobia, you know, that you find it in three registers, in the three registers that we associate with Lacan's work, you know, the imaginary, the symbolic, and the real. And I suppose when we do talk about, throughout the book, we talk about how you know, mostly under, you know, under neoliberalism and at this stage of late capitalism, that, you know, our semblable is someone that we have to compete with, and that this can, you know, arouse a kind of jealous or aggressive rivalry with our neighbor, with our counterpart. So that's the kind of imaginary dimension. And then at the level of the symbolic, we see how xenophobia can be both hidden in and also, you know, and very effectively disguised by various discourses, not least, you know, let's say, discourses which promote political correct speech and practice, but also at the level of ideology. And that would be this sort of symbolic dimension. And by the ideology, I mean things like ideological practices like, you know, multiculturalism and identity politics, which are all ways of trying to organize under one signifier, difference, right? But difference, which is supposedly tolerant of alterity, of the alterity of the other, but nonetheless rely on difference as it could be regulated by or represented by the signifier. So then we focus on xenophobia in the real, and that's where we talk about, you know, jouissance of the subject, jouissance of the other. And the jouissance of the subject is the one that we've been sort of talking about, where something is imagined to be stolen from you, your objet a, the thing that's taken away from you by the foreign, the strange, the alien other. And then on the other hand, there is the jouissance of the other, which is unfathomable and terrifying. And that is something that we try to distance ourselves from. So there's those two aspects of the kind of real dimension of xenophobia.
And the subtitle for that chapter is, I'm not racist, but...
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a very good reason for that subtitle. Did we say I am, or did we say we are not? I think we said We are not. That's right. We are not racist.
We are not racists, but correct.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason for that was because, I mean, we wanted to, I suppose we were looking at the different ways in which negation, which is to say a way to deny or attempt to, you know, to say that, no, you know, we're all, you know, we're all kind of good, decent people here trying to understand and embrace difference, trying to work with our fellow man and woman to get along and make the best of things. And so, of course, that's essentially a way to negate the experience of ambivalence, which brings us, that brings us full circle in the book, because that's where we begin. We begin with the idea that, we don't really buy that. We see in the clinic, we see in culture, the attempts to somehow push ambivalence under, push it away. It's not recognized any longer as something which is, you know, essential to the human condition or the experience of being a human being. So as such, we begin the book by looking at how ambivalence, or rather the tensions of ambivalence, how they are foreclosed. So in, you know, with Freud and Lacan, we take then negation. We look at the three different types of negation in that chapter. We look at foreclosure, but we begin with repression, and then we look at disavowal, and then we find, you know, we finish off where we began, which is on foreclosure. So disavowal would be one of the mechanisms of negation, which is linked in Lacanian psychoanalysis to perversion. But we That whole, the sort of the statement, I am not a racist, but this comes from the Octave Manoni's, his Je sais bien, mais quand même, which is this kind of fetishist disavowal. Zizek has made made huge use of that, that formula. And you see it in quite kind of everyday discourse. I think the example in the book that we used was from a study of college students carried out in the year 2000, where, a typical kind of comment would be, and the college students, were interviewed about prejudice. And you'd have someone say something like, well, I'm not prejudiced or whatever, but... And so the recognition of, you know, how one is supposed to be, or rather what is, you know, what one is supposed to be without, but it's quite, you know, quickly followed with the but. And then you have the reason for your discontent, which is rolled out. But it's not because you're racist. It's because of something else. And I suppose, you know, one of the things that we loved about Sheldon George's book was that he really shows how, racial kind of, you can have a kind of transformation of racial hatred expressed as an intolerance of violence. And that's kind of a core argument in his analysis of, you know, the ways in which especially young Black men have been slaughtered really in the last number of decades, on the basis that there was something intolerant about their behavior rather than it was because they were Black, you know?
Yeah, he joined us on the podcast in another episode with our editor, Tracy Morgan.
Right.
I was also thinking about the ambivalence in Jewish Hans. This is decades old. I don't think it happens anymore. But it used to be, you would say to somebody, well, it's okay that you're gay as long as you act straight in public.
Right.
That used to be very common.
Right, but you wouldn't hear that anymore. But that doesn't mean that it wouldn't be thought, you know. There's the fantasy that because things are quote unquote better now, that in a certain way, this means that things have actually changed. You know, they look like they've changed, so they must have changed. But people can still think these things, of course. I heard yesterday on the news here in Ireland that, it's Pride here at the moment. I don't know if it's Pride in the US at this time of the year, but typically, you know, there would be Pride March and, you know, lots of celebrations of, you know, LGBTQ communities across Ireland. And as you probably know, I don't know if it's common knowledge, but Ireland was, I still think one of the very few countries that actually voted in marriage equality, as, you know, by popular vote rather than, you know, by law. I mean, it's law now, but we voted for it by referendum. Now, so you would think, wouldn't you? You'd think, well, this is pretty cool. This is great. My God, that's fantastic. It's so progressive. But I heard in the last day or two that there are, you know, there have been, you know, the Pride flags have been taken down and burnt in different communities in Ireland, and buildings, you know, LGBTQ buildings have been defaced, or, you know, with kind of hate graffiti. So it's just, you know, it's, if you push something down hard enough and fast enough, and this is our argument, it will still find a way to come back, you know, and yeah, in a nutshell. So you can try to negate it whichever way you like, either by law or by ideology, but it will find its way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
As we talk about this and racism in general and the book, Stephanie, you have examples, things in the current cultural moment that illustrate what we're talking about.
Yeah. You know, certainly we could see the riot, attempted insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building in January of this year as one instructive example of xenophobia, as well as extremacy, insofar as maybe we shouldn't forget that fear and hatred of our outgroup political party can itself be a form of xenophobia. It clearly wasn't restricted to that, as you know, a reporter who was present on the scene, you know, commented, you know, one man was carrying a Confederate flag through the building. There's a black member of the Capitol Police, I believe, who said during the assault he was called a racial slur 15 some times. And you know, we certainly remember scenes of the rather horrifying jouissance of the rioters, including, you know, beating a police officer with a pole flying the US flag. But one New Yorker reporter had mentioned that one of the chants of the crowd had been, "Whose house? Our house." You know, claiming that you know, that was their house, the White House. And, you know, clearly they were deriving jouissance from their xenophobia, from their racism, as they tried to eject those that they hated from the borders of, you know, what they claimed as our house. Of course they're seeing the other as having stolen something that was rightfully theirs, barging in where they weren't wanted, and here they're doing, you know, the exact same thing via intimacy.
I was just thinking, I mean, obviously I could jump in and mention that, you know, in the book, we, when we talk about these types of examples, although this one is very recent, the one that you've just mentioned, we do talk about how, the collapsing, the border is a signifier of, you know, the threat of your objet à being taken away from you. So the collapsing borders or the erection of a wall, for example. And I suppose we gave, you know, the example in the European context of Brexit, which, you know, I mean, it was years and years in the coming. And certainly when, you know, we highlighted how some British people were, you know, the pro-Brexit people who were really pro-Brexit were going around with, you know, placards and banners saying, we want our country back and we are not Europeans. So again, this, you know, we want something back, which is ours. And, you know, and by the same token, the kind of disidentifying with the alien, strange, foreign other whose jouissance you don't identify with as, and you certainly don't identify it as your own. So we kind of ironically call that a Brextimate, you know, ambivalence rather than just extimate ambivalence. But yeah, that's just it, you know, that you can find it, you know, it's great. You know, you find these examples here, there, and everywhere, you know, because as we were, you know, as we were saying just a few minutes ago, Stephanie, when you were out, that it was, you know, it's something that we see, you know, the more and more and more we try, or cultures try to negate ambivalence or negate the expression of the tensions of ambivalence, the more it returns in all sorts of other ways, which are very public and very performative, and often quite dangerous, you know, certainly incendiary.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking, Stephanie, when you said the, the Confederate flag in the Capitol, but if you speak to people that fly it, they will say, oh, it represents heritage, not hate.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's interesting with the Brexit example, and there's been two, you know, I think, you know, full page big articles in the business section of the New York Times, that the top tables, you know, the top restaurants in Britain, because they don't have European workers, they can't staff them. They can't open. They're cutting back hours because they don't have the other to serve, you know, to serve in the restaurants.
Exactly.
I mean, it's really amazing.
That's going to be a problem. Yeah,
it is going to be a problem.
Another recent thing in that vein, you know, we've seen since the beginning of the pandemic, a notable rise in xenophobia against people who appear to be Asian, xenophobia.
Yeah. And now Indian with the new Delta variant.
Right. Yeah. And certainly attempts, you know, to separate and you know, segregate. Not frequenting, Asian stores and et cetera.
Well, segregation.
Go ahead,
I mean,
Carol.
Well, no, just that. Segregation and separation have traditionally been, historically been ways of trying to manage, you know, this precisely this kind of extimate ambivalence that we're talking about. I mean, how else can you manage it if you cannot, you know, build up a fence against it or a wall, build a defense against it, or push it away in some way? So totally separate from it or segregate it. That's what
we're or shoot it in the example that is coming to mind with this past March, the Robert Aaron Long, the shooter at the massage parlors in the Atlanta, Georgia area, you know, shot 8 people to death. And, you know, he said that the shootings represented a temptation he wanted to eliminate, and that he had been motivated by a sexual addiction that was at odds with his religious beliefs, you know, so he was, you know, literally killing the other in order to try to eradicate his own hated jouissance. You know, that via extimacy, we can see that the hatred of the Asian women's jouissance that's evident in Sinophobia actually points to the shooter's own hatred of his jouissance, you know, this sexual enjoyment that's attached to, you know, specifically Asian women. And of course the massage parlors, you know, didn't necessarily need to be providing sexual massages, and that's a stereotype, but he certainly sought out a violent solution to eradicate his ambivalence about his own jouissance. And we see that in such horrific magnitude, as well as in much smaller ways that you might only notice in the clinic.
Well, to talk about noticing things in the clinic, there's an old saw that says, you know, analysis begins when the analyst becomes the problem. But I'm always aware of when a patient identifies what they think is my jouissance. So, you know, a recent example, I say to somebody, I'm going to be out of the office next Tuesday. Can we meet on Wednesday? They say yes. And on the Wednesday, they come in and like, how was your day off? As if it was this incredible, you know, wonderful time that I had had. You know, those clues when they begin to be critical of how you live, well, you must enjoy a nice life. You know, then they begin to be critical of what they see the analyst jouissance is. I think we begin to get to the core of the ambivalence in the clinic.
Absolutely. It certainly shows up in the transference as well. And all the, you know, it's often almost amusing the various different ways in which our analysands assign us a certain jouissance. But it's obvious that it belongs to them, even if, you know, there's some, you know, quote unquote objective reality to whatever it is their comment may be.
So I want to shift to another part of the book that I think is important, and culturally, tomorrow in New York is Father's Day.
We have
fathers in the book,
and of course today is Juneteenth.
Today is Juneteenth. We're recording on Juneteenth. It's the perfect weekend for this.
Checking all the boxes.
You know, I want to get into to fathers because, you know, somewhere I think in the fabric of affect, Andre Green says, you know, the Oedipal situation is what defines us. You write, Lacan himself claimed that perhaps the Oedipal show has run its course, but we are not convinced. What we see Oedipally speaking, rather, is how the father is still the symptom of the son. So tell me again, you know, sort of following the same pattern, what did you see in the clinic? And then what are you seeing the different types of father figure functioning that we're seeing culturally that you brought into the book?
Well, I think that because, you know, one huge thread of our argument in the book is that ambivalence is an index of some kind. Okay, it's an index certainly of when something is important to you. So that could be, of course, could have an unconscious importance to you. And then importance itself is kind of interesting because you think, well, what even does that mean? So for us as psychoanalysts, we think, well, you know, if we, you know, starting with Freud and, you know, and it's certainly there in Lacan for a very, very long time, what is important to us from the very beginning of our lives is the love that we have and the love that we experience, and however that love might be experienced from and by our parents. So from the Oedipal beginnings, you know, we have very clear from the Freudian point of view, you know, that your love and your hate is going to be directed in two particular ways. I think we touched on this a little bit last time, but to make the point that, you know, from the point of view of Oedipal ambivalence, we can understand it as beginning with the Freudian Oedipus complex, but we should also see that most forms of neurotic guilt, even if most neurotics come into you and they're not saying things like, I really want to have sex with my mother, and I think I really want to kill my father. They're usually saying things like, I feel really guilty about the way that I'm relating to my girlfriend, or I feel particularly guilty about the fact that, you know, I would like to leave this person, but still have, you know, strong feelings for them. So in other words, or even just, I feel guilty, I didn't fill out my tax return, or I didn't fill it out properly. So in other words, that the kind of really quite banal ways that people speak about their guilt actually, in some ways, belie a more typical kind of prototypical Oedipal experience, Oedipal ambivalence. So we cling on to that in the book. We think it's really important because we see it in our clinics, and we think it operates in culture in all sorts of ways, which obviously we can go on and talk about. But we don't stop there because we are cognizant of the fact that we don't just see, a kind of Oedipalized ambivalence. We see something else. And that something else is where we have to kind of look at the, if you like, the kind of different iterations of what we would say after Lacan, the names of the father in our culture and in our time. So I don't know if you want to pop in, Stephanie, and then I can come back in later on if you want to just, I don't know, pop in and I'll come back.
Sure, yeah. One thought is that, with Lacan's 17th seminar, he commented that the Oedipus complex, he reworks and basically says that increasingly in our times, his time in the 70s, what we're seeing is a decline in the typical position of the father figure as, authority. With that comes a kind of losing our bearings in the way of how to answer the question of who and how to be regarding our jouissance. Because the various father complexes that we find in Totem and Taboo and the Oedipus myth, both function to explain, why jouissance is prohibited, limited, and speak to how our desire is oriented in accordance with which, you know, moral law. In this new discourse, a new form of social relation, which Lacan called the capitalist discourse, we have a different kind of ideal. You know, basically, in times of neoliberalism, what's commanded is enjoying yourself. You know, you're supposed to be completely happy and, you know, fully satisfied and pursue your own enjoyment. And of course, that ensures that that's not going to happen. So that's this kind of new superegoic master figure. A kind of different, you know, as a superegoic jouisseur, of the primal father, who is seen as making the subject guilty for not enjoying themselves enough or failing to be authentically themselves, whatever the case may be. And so the new source of discontents, in our times compared to civilization and its discontents, you know, when Freud was writing that in the 1930s, Lacan says is that we're a culture of permissiveness. You know, that there's a kind of prohibition on prohibiting, so to speak, that creates situations of suffering. So just really briefly, the capitalist discourse essentially helps us deny our lack in jouissance, because instead of addressing instead of addressing our subjective complaints to an other via the social link, we look for something that could via this kind of consumerist culture. So in the discourse, it's represented by an S1. We reach towards that self-help book or that empathy training program or that new house, that it's thought that there's some object or some experience, that next vacation. You know, if only we could have that, then we'll really be able to fully enjoy ourselves. And so it's a kind of way to deny castration, that is wrapped up in this new new fashion of kind of different father version that we're relating to. And so Lacan says, you know, basically the problem is there's no longer any shame. And so it creates new types of symptoms in the clinic. And I've talked for a while. I don't know if you want to jump in, Carol.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that I know, Christopher, you asked about the kind of, like what was our take really, given that we say our take in the book about, you know, Oedipus is that we still see it, you know, Oedipus is alive and well, you know, in a very ordinary way. I want to say, because you said about, you know, where do we find, what sort of example in the clinic? Well, a really ordinary one would be the kind of the degradation of a man, the unwitting or unconscious degradation of a man, of his father. And this quite often occurs. So the one that comes to mind is a man I was seeing for a long time, and he had one brother, okay? But he would regularly say, my sisters and brothers. And I would say, your brothers? He would go, I don't mean my brothers. I mean my brothers. And again, he'd say, my brothers. I said, your brothers? No, my brother, my sisters, and my father. Okay. So it was so difficult for him not to include his father as a brother when he would speak about his family. So in the analysis, what he had to be able to come to articulate was how he really saw his father as a weak, you know, feeble, very much, you know, a character in the background without any real power or sway in the family. In fact, you know, his mother was the one who made most of the decisions. And yes, his father went out to work and he had a decent job and so on and so forth, and he provided for them. But, you know, he was a quiet man sitting in the corner and he did not respect his opinion. So this kind of weak father, this kind of father who doesn't properly embody the law, the transmission of the law, this is a regular feature of neurotic clinic.
I was just about to say,
and Freud knew well.
But the, you know, the image that came to mind with inviting that person in was the TV series The Sopranos, where the therapist, Dr. Melfi, has been assaulted, and she has the monster. She has Tony Soprano, who she knows that she could invite him in to do justice. I mean, she knows he's a monster and a killer.
To be the primal father.
Mm-hmm. To be the primal father. And watching it, you both want her to and don't want her to, and she doesn't. I was thinking about, you know, this command, you must enjoy, which is, it is absolutely prevalent. Patients who, what they come in is they say that they're not enjoying and that is why they're seeking treatment. And what they present is, at least to me, just being a human being, but the fact that they're not 100% happy all the time. There's some, I don't know if it's a meme or some saying out there that says, unless you say to life, absolutely yes, it's an absolute no, like there's no room for doubt at all. This is a common, I see this a lot, in the command to enjoy.
And the distinction there between demand and desire, I think, is important. Every so often I'll use the term, well, just the word desire, with an analysand, and they'll think I mean demand. And that's certainly what the capitalist discourse enables, the kind of social link, that it just flattens desire and reduces it to demand. There is, as you were saying, you know, what is it that you want? It is X. Well, go get it. And certainly we see that in psychotherapy all the time. And in patients who, you know, every once in a while have a patient who says, oh, you know, you were the closest to my office or something, and they have no idea that I'm an analyst, and, you know, they'll demand, you know, coping skills as their S1, or so, you know, we have that to reckon with, you know, that there's this true belief that there is something that will answer one's discontents.
Well, I think when you say desire, Adam Phillips has, one of his, among many things that he says wonderfully, he says, an analyst is someone you have a desire to talk to and who has a desire to listen to you.
Yeah, I don't know that he does either. Desire, just in brief Lacanian terms, is, you know, that could be unconscious. And so it's a real question of what is it that the other desires, that the other wants from me, and what is it, you know, correspondingly that the subject desires. And there is no, it's a metonymic,
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, Steph, when you say that the person who shows up saying, well, you were closest to my office, they don't know you're an analyst. They don't know your desire, the unconscious. There's a wonderful a paper a woman wrote called How to Be a Good Patient, and it just reverses everything. And she says, since patients end up suffering from whatever it is that their analysts treat, they should understand that in choosing an analyst, they're also selecting their pathology.
Yeah. I'll put that on my intake paperwork.
So we're coming to the end of our sec part two of our two-part interview. Is there anything in the two hours we've had together that hasn't been expressed or covered that you'd like to comment on so that the listeners have a feel for the book and its arguments?
You know, since the publication of this book, especially, you know, when I encounter other psychoanalysts and they want to, you know, chat with me about our book, they'll often have that. Well, what do we do about, you know, our xenophobia? What do we do at the cultural level? And it's a very complex and important question, because you know, as Carol said, you know, while we do see ambivalence about our own jouissance being at the root of xenophobia, and you know, very much speaking to how we you know, xenophobia very much speaks to how we avoid facing our lack, our own jouissance, and you know, analysis is really a one-on-one thing that we see that works, and it's just very tough in terms of activism and you know, group efforts to you know, to work through the tensions of one's ambivalence about the other.
Okay, what do we like to finish the episodes with? What are you working on now? Are you working on something together or individual? Oh, wow.
Both.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, our next book project is on liminality, how we see that in the culture and in the clinic. And we've done some presentations and a publication now on the way as kind of shorter things, but that's a work in progress.
All right. Very good. We have been talking with Dr. Stephanie Swales, Dr. Carol Owens. Their book is Psychoanalyzing Ambivalence with Freud and Lacan. Dr. Swales, Dr. Owens, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thanks, Christopher. It was lovely.